as well. And we use empirical research and analysis to develop policy as we move forward. We provide the minister with advice. Sometimes the minister asks for advice, but he has to ask advice in terms of the act or specific programs that are being put in place for the higher education sector. But we also proactively advise the minister on matters that we see of concern and could actually jeopardize the integrity of our system. We have in the previous year advised the minister on this education provision. As you know, it appears in the white paper on higher education, on post-school education, that the distance component should be sharpened in such a way that most people can have access to higher education. And as with UNISA, which was the sole main provider of this, to spread out and help out. So we provided that advice. And of course, with the establishment of the two universities in Mpumalanga we advise the minister on the disestablishment of national institutes, because otherwise we will duplicate services and actually that cost that will be incurred. These are small institutions, as you know, for start, but they have been established, and we're sure that they will grow and meet the targets that are set by government by 2030. And of course, draft regulations, we advise the minister on the National Institute for Humanities and Social Sciences, which in his view needed attention as well as much as we do with SETs, the sciences, engineering and technology, because the humanities are actually, as you know, part of the development of a nation in different ways, including social sciences. And of course, with the big problem that we have about student housing around institutions, as you may know, people travel from far, sometimes there's no capacity at universities, sometimes the capacity, there are provision of these facilities, but they're not up to scratch. So there was a commission, the minister commissioned a report to actually visit a sample of institutions to inform the student housing arrangements. We advise on that as well and what nonsense standards should be followed going forward. It is still work in progress because student housing has got many facets to it that actually could become quite costly. And under the environment that the universities don't actually get funding for housing and accommodation, we have to ring fence and see how best we can be able to do what we can more or less. And then lastly, Jefferson, there was a draft on higher education training information policy, because information forms the backbone of what we do in infrastructures. And proactively advise the Minister of Education Centres and the programs that are offered there, because some people use foreign institutions in our country who may not necessarily go through our accreditation arrangements, and then there are perceptions that this could be money-making schemes that we want to get. So we advise the Minister on that. Chairperson, I will pause here and ask Mr. Esson to proceed with the objectives that you have set and what we have achieved so far, and where we still have work in progress. And I realize that Parliament doesn't like this work in progress. You have to support it's done, follow done. And I will leave it to Parliament. Thank you.
Procrastination is a thief of time.
Thank you, Chair. As Dr. Chair said, we have four strategic goals and 11 strategic objectives. I'll take you through in
shows what we've done in the life of the Rashi Mark, our strategic objective tools, it's really the research work and the development work that we do, shows more than one financial year. And I'm sure academics amongst you would appreciate that it's not possible always to complete some of these projects within a given financial year. So we started 4 or 5 projects last year in the last financial year, which will be completed in the course of this financial year. As you know, one of the big projects we had was we had established the council, we established the task team that was chaired by Professor Ndebele, who was looking at the reform of the undergraduate curriculum structure, which really speaks to the whole issue of the fact that large numbers of young people are not adequately prepared for higher education and leave from school, and also drop out from higher education. That report was completed. We've gone through a consultation process, and the council will be finalizing its advice to the minister later this year. We also had a project on governance challenges in higher education. We started out by looking at those institutions that have been under administration. The project has been completed, and the council is currently considering the release of a document that's proposing new ways of structuring institutional councils. And that will also be finalized at the last council meeting in November this year. We've also had a major project on a review of higher education, which we brought together a range of academic experts in 8 working groups, policy experts in higher education, that is. And that project is currently the chapter that we've written, they're called Critical Readers, and have been revised and edited, and will be ready for release in the new year. We have a project on student governance, which is ongoing. We've undertaken interviews with SLC members across the country. They are currently being transcribed and analyzed. And then finally, we had an ongoing project on reflections on academic leadership. We've asked a group of retired vice chancellors, deputy vice chancellors, and so on, to reflect on what is it that makes a good leader and manager in higher education, given the kinds of problems that we have in a range of institutions. That project is currently also being finalized, and we intend bringing our book on that next year. So that very broadly is the projects we've done in terms of the big research projects, which we hope will come to fruition in the course of at the end of this financial year. In terms of publications, as you may be aware, we released the report of the task team curriculum before. We have an ongoing publication on vital statistics, which each year we add in new statistics to. The latest one, which is currently with the publishers, is also having now statistics on the financial state of higher education, which we didn't have before. We presented Osakwa Gazette's higher education qualification sub-framework last year. You'll be pleased to note, in relation to the earlier discussion about the BTEC, that the higher education qualification sub-framework has now done away with the BTEC as a qualification. It will not be offered in the future. It's been replaced by an advanced diploma and so forth for a range of reasons, which I won't go into now, but we can talk about if you want. And then finally, we launched, as you may know, as we may have mentioned when we came a few months ago, in February this year, the Quality Enhancement Project. Our focus going forward, really, the 2 big projects we have, the Quality Enhancement Project, which is in part linked to the review of the curriculum. It targets the teaching and learning, enhancing teaching and learning. How do we improve teaching and learning? How do we address the particular problems of students who are underprepared who enter higher education, given 50% of young people are part of our qualification. So that's been a key focus going forward that we need to do. As part of this, we had regional seminars last year by education institutions on the quality of teaching and learning. We had 800 people across 3 seminars that we held with an American expert on learning and teaching, Vincent Pinter. We had a seminar in Cape Town, one in Boysville-Natal, and one in Gauteng, to which all the institutions participated. We also had a seminar with stakeholders when we released the review of the curriculum reform to engage them on the proposals of the task team. In terms of qualifications, the development of qualifications, as you know, with the National Qualifications Framework Act, we have additional responsibilities outside of our normal quality service work. As I indicated, we released the Higher Education Qualifications Framework last year, and we finalized the review of what are called the JPA programs. All of the programs, qualifications offered by institutions where there were minimal changes required to conform
to the requirements of the qualification framework. I should say that what this process is doing, there were some 20,000 odd qualifications on institutional books nationally. Many of them were no longer being offered. In some cases, they were outdated and so forth. We think by the time we finish this project, which will be sometime in the middle of next year, there's likely to be less than 10,000. It's allowed institutions to clean up their own sort of program offerings and what they can have on their books. So it's been a fairly onerous project and intense project for institutions, but I think it's also in the business today. In terms of standards development, this is the one project that's been much slower to take off, largely because we depend on academics to develop the standards, and the academics has been notoriously slow in thinking about what they do and how they do it and so forth. But we are going by far. We started the Bachelor of Social Work. We've done the MBA. We're also in discussions around the LLB qualification. As you know, there's been a big debate about the LLB and whether the current qualification is appropriate and so forth. And our view was that before you can decide what kind of qualification the LLB should be in terms of whether it's a 4, 5, 6 year qualification, we need to have a better understanding of what legal profession and legal academic training a legal graduate should have. And so we've been working with deans of law in developing a standard for law graduates. In strategic objective 5, we expected to maintain in terms of the National Learner Record Database, all the learner achievements that everybody can complete the qualification. We are responsible for ensuring that it's recorded from the NLRD. In the case of public higher education institutions, this is done by the Department of Higher Education and Training through the Higher Education Management Information System. We have an agreement with the department to submit the information directly to ACWA. In the case of private higher education institutions, we have to take direct responsibility. In fact, it's a project that managed from our behalf by SACWA because we don't have the internal computer technical capacity, technological capacity to manage the project. But the big program or the big project we've been working there is not so much sending the data for student enrollment and achievement, but at the moment, and as you know, possibly even in the white paper, the green paper, for school education, we just don't know enough about what goes in private higher education. We don't have comparable information for private higher education that we have for public higher education in terms of student numbers, what kind of programs they study, and so forth. So working with the DAPG and SACWA, we've developed, and with the private providers, we've developed new set of specifications, which currently are being piloted, and we hope will be introduced as soon as the audit is completed. In terms of the auditing of institutions, as you know, we've been doing this over the last 10 years. We've come to the end of that stage. There's certain audits that are ongoing. We closed in the last financial year and audited for the Cape Peninsula University, UJ, and the University of Limpopo. The other audits are currently in process, and we hope will be completed or closed off in the course of next year. As you know, we indicated before at the last meeting, I think, that we are not continuing with audits over the next 4 years, because we're going to focus on the quality enhancement project, which we must intend to do. Because we really want to focus on what goes on in the classroom, which is not an audit process, not a compliance process, but to see how can we improve teaching and learning by bringing institutions to consider what best practices in teaching and learning and so forth is. In terms of program accreditation, which I suppose is the bread and butter of the CAT, on an annual basis, last year we accredited 492 programs, which was a 42% increase. The increase is large part to do with the fact that the new teacher education qualifications that have come on stream, so institutions are having to recalculate and submit programs, new teacher education programs for accreditation. And in part, as part of the alignment of programs to the new higher education qualification framework, also a large number of programs that will no longer be offered. Institutions are having to develop new programs to education, either because their programs are outdated, in the case of the VTEC, which is going to be replaced by the advanced development and so forth, so there are many more new programs from public institutions that are coming in. But previously, a lot of our accreditation was largely being with private providers. We also worked with DAPG to facilitate the fast tracking of the accreditation of the programs for the two new universities. We started and we have just completed a national review of the Bachelor of Social Work, which is a very focused look at what in a particular program or qualification to try to upgrade that, to enhance the quality of that program. As you know, in the past we've done things for the MBA, which was fairly contentious a number of years ago, as well as teacher education.
Social work is now complete and the ACTC will be making final decisions at its November meeting. In terms of the general promotion of quality, I've already mentioned the three seminars we have on student success and the seminar on the undergraduate curriculum reform. We hold a series of what we call quality assurance forums where we bring together, in the case of public institutions, the managers in the institutions who are responsible for quality assurance, likewise the private institutions, to work with them about whatever new developments are taking place, what they expect to do in terms of accreditation and so forth. We also work with the statutory professional councils, because as you know, we accredit programs, but in the case where the professional council, where the requirement for the student is that the professional council registration is certificate for practice, the programs also have to be accredited by the professional council. This is a big issue because there are concerns, there's tensions, there have been historical tensions between the HFUC and professional councils about who is responsible in terms of the legislation. There are also concerns about higher education institutions about inclusion by professional councils on curriculum matters and so forth, as well as the cost that professional councils charge. We currently have a process with professional councils and the institutions to try to address that. And then we run a whole lot of workshops for the people who do the evaluation of programs. We don't evaluate the programs ourselves, we don't have the expertise, so it's a peer-driven process, so we speak in higher education institutions in the sector when we accredit programs or when we audit people. So that requires us to train the people in the methodology that we use and so forth, and we have ongoing workshops on an annual basis. We have very close relationships with the Southern African quality assurance agencies and councils that have been set up and have been established in recent times, and we usually get delegations from other countries coming to look at our systems when they're starting their new, when they're establishing their own systems. And then finally, in terms of the sort of support, if you want, the corporate services, the Minister of Finance and Technical Services, as you know, and I understand it was an issue, there may have been an issue about numbers at the last meeting. Our big issue is staff recruitment and retention. I'm pleased to say in the last year, our staff turnover has gone down from 10.9%. We have 53 posts on our staff establishment. At the end of the financial year, 46 of those were filled. The council had made a decision, which is still stands, that there were 3 administrative posts where we didn't immediately need staff. So effectively, we're working with a staff complement of 50. We've sort of frozen the 3 posts that we don't immediately need. So we have 46 of the posts filled. Currently stands at 48 in the current financial year. Our big issue was staffing, well, there are 2 issues. One is at the senior levels. We are unable to compete with the universities, which is something new. In the past, public service salaries were a lot better than higher education salaries, so the city was able to attract in the staff from institutions. That's turned around. And then secondly, in the case of more junior staff, because the organization is small, opportunities for career progression are limited. So it's so far people can go once they develop skills and so forth. And often we're getting people to then find more senior positions in other organizations using higher education. So it's sort of musical chairs between us and higher education institutions. I'm pleased to say that the Minister and the Minister of Finance approved at the end of the financial year a new remuneration framework for senior staff, which will allow the council, where appropriate, to offer what we call a non-pensionable allowance of up to 20% in order to attract or retain senior staff in the organization. We've also introduced, as part of HR process, an employee wellness program. I'm pleased to say I was one of the first members of the staff when we did the assessment. We also started a program to employ interns. We employed 3 interns last year for the year, and one of them is continuing to work on our IT system. In terms of financial and administrative systems, we have an ongoing updating of our policies and strengthening our internal financial systems. A lot of them are putting now in the room electronically. We also changed the fee policy that we charge department providers. In the past, we used to refund the programs were not accredited at the different stages. It's a very complicated administrative process. We now introduce a non-refundable fee when they apply. I'm going to hand over to the CFO, but before I do so, let me go through the in terms of the base profile, we have 72% African 17% white, 9% colored, 9% Indian, and 2% colored. Our big problem with the shades is that we don't have enough men. As you can see, 76% of our staff are female, 24% are men, and that is an issue in the organization. We're saving a stock point. We've recently been able to employ more senior men in academic positions, the CFO and the director. Previously, I was in sort of low range in senior management. The one difficulty we have had is we've not been able to attract onto our staff people with disabilities, and we have a program and a framework to try to address that. I'm going to hand over, but before I hand over to the CFO, let me, at least in light of the previous discussion with the Ms. Fush, we have an unqualified audit, we didn't have a clean audit. We had, in relation to what is the ATQC online, which is the system that we use for program accreditation, which we started developing in 2006, which again, fairly major budget item. We've interpreted the ATQC online to be a live system ongoing. Because the general disagrees with our interpretation, the AG believes that we have to write it off each year because it's an intensive list. We had a major dispute with the AG about the interpretation. In the end, we conceded. So we had to check our financial statements as a result of that. Our one big deal for the Auditor General is we've been audited for a number of years. We started this project in 2006. None of us were there at the time. We checked an Auditor General 8 years to come to the conclusion that what the way we were reporting, which is a fairly major ratified item, is about 1 million rand a year, that there were extensive reservations about how we reported. We did have one or two other minor transitions. We did not get the report from one or two of the suppliers when we gave out the tender. We did check on databases that anybody was involved, but we didn't actually get the paperwork. So we accept that there's some internal control that we need to send them. I think given members of this committee would not be aware, but 4 or 5 years ago, when SHAGES went through a difficult period, there were major problems with the internal systems and so forth. We think we've addressed about 90% of the problems, and we've got also to go forward to bring all of that up.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Principal and Chairperson of the committee and members of this committee. I'll just quickly present the financial budgetary summary, which I think the important is the financial performance of SHAGES. The slide that I'm presenting, it gives a reflection of what was received as revenue and what was spent, but at the summary level. Just to indicate to the members, just not for confusion, SHAGES relies on the grant from the Department of Higher Education and Training. Other revenue that are highlighted there are just projected revenue, which simply means that it might happen that we can project more and receive less, or we can project this amount and receive higher. So the percentage is reflected that you will see, for example, this private accreditation with 235%. It's an indication that we projected this amount, but we received more. So same applies to other revenue that are highlighted there. In total, we had a revenue of 61 million. Inclusion of the request for retaining the rollover of funds from the private for the prior financial year to 18 million. Now it amounted to 61. When you look at the total expenditure, we had about 50 million, and then it gives us the total of the unspent as the rollover that we are going to request for the next financial year at 10 million. Goods and services stands at 26% spent, and I think the main reason there is just that because in CHE we operate with projects, and the project does not align to the financial year period. Some of the projects start in the middle of the financial year, some start at the second quarter of the financial year, so they overlap to the next financial year. So some of the reasons why the goods and services they are under sort of an understanding of that 20-24% is because of the project that we embark on in terms of our work. And also highlight to members that these projects
normally touch very important four accounts, same items. It's consultancy, it's traveling, which is traveling locally and abroad, it's also accommodation and catering. For the simple reason that the project that we embark on requires us to travel more. Hence our traveling spending items is more, and our consultancy spending is more. It's not about hiring consultancy, it's about getting colleagues from other universities, professors and doctors who are sick in terms of giving their advice as our objective to the Minister of Higher Education. So I wanted to explain that, so when we look at the financial year as the place now, I want to report when we look at the spending items, the question of right consultancy is higher. Why are we doing as the CHD to address that? It's because of that assistance that we need from the peers from our other institutions to fast-track our projects. The personnel, as my CEO indicated, is at 91 because of the unfunded posts that were not filled when the financial year ends. Ticket is high by one thing because we had an emergency at our building when we had to fix some of the maintenance, and then each automatically increase our key pace to be high because of that particular item. On the next slide, we are just trying to highlight to the members, just to know, you will see that the spending is exactly the same as the previous slide. We are just trying to highlight to members to know that without the rollover of funds, we are supposed to be at 47. This simply means that CEC cannot be lying from time to time about rollover of funds, which simply says that whatever that we get as a grant is not enough for us to then achieve the intended objectives of CEC. So we are just trying to highlight and show you the difference between when we included the rollover funds, which we have not approved, and when we don't have the rollover funds. In terms of the reporting of AG, we have so the CEO indicated received an adequate fund credit report. The emphasis from the AG is that of the two issues that you raised, where we had to restate the figures. I personally, as the CEO, was not happy with that. We cannot be giving auditors that have been auditing the same auditing that has been auditing the same institution for years, and now come with a different interpretation of the government, and possibly ask the institution to restate the figures. And my worry, and I want to raise it to this committee, is that what if next year we get different audit committee and different decision? Are we now going to change again because of their thinking and trying to change? And that is very tricky. And I raise it, I think the issue is aware of that. But there are two issues. It was the issue of the system that we are using, and also the incorrect classification of the operating needs. The question is, they have been auditing the same operating needs for years. Now they just recently this year identified that the way we are classifying all the issues is not correct, so we have to rethink. And those are the major issues that were raised by auditors. Other issues is internal control efficiencies, which we have addressed. Just to report to the House, we have developed a strategic audit action plan to address all 22 findings that we find that were picked up by the auditors. And as we speak now, the report will be submitted to Council in terms of the progress that has been made. Just as we recently met with the auditing committee, where we presented progress in respect of the findings. Majority of them has been addressed as we speak. We hope that coming next year will be a very closer to clean audit report, but the intention is to have a very clean audit report as the chairperson highlighted before. I think thank you, Chair.
So, Chair, can I just add? I think in terms of financial ones, we just note we had a deficit on our main grants. So, we've got 41 million, just under 42 million from the Department of Higher Education and Training, and then together with the money we got from our private accreditation and so forth, we had a deficit of, I think it was 3.7 million. We had a deficit because our current grant does not allow us to do everything that we need to do. We managed the deficit because we've had historical rollovers, and we had a private accreditation that goes up and down. So last year we got a lot more for private accreditation than we had in previous years. So we are concerned, not in the next year or two, because we still have rollovers to play around with, but our concern going forward that we would have difficulties or we would have prioritized differently. I think the real reason for the problem that we face is that salaries in the public sector have been going up, budgets have been cut. So if you take our current budget in the last year, this year I think it's 44 million rand. Our salary budget, if we were to pay all our 53 staff at the maximum of the salary scale, salary budget would be 30 million of the 46, of the 44 million that we're getting. So it's about more than 60% of the budget. And that's not because we can increase staff or increase salaries ourselves. That's the nature of the way personnel costs have gone up, while budget has been cut for operational costs in general, given the broader sort of concern about the economy and so on. But I think the committee needs to be aware of that. We think we're okay for the next 2 years because we've got some cushion with the role of the funds that we have. The Treasury has indicated, at least the message we've received, is certainly for the next 2 years there's more indication of increased budgets. Then they start looking at additional funding from the third year of the NGA onwards. So we are going to have to watch our budgets very carefully. It may affect our programs if there's no funding coming forward in the next 2 years or so. Thank you.
By different presenters. I will now invite panel members to reflect on the briefing by the Council of Higher Education. The Council of Higher Education. On Council on Higher Education. Thank you very much. But I wanted to correct me. Okay. There are some. Professor Fodoli, Ms. Killian, Ms. Ntunu, Ms. Galimene, Mr. Siwela, and Mr. Kekani. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I was sitting here wondering what the point is of the CIG. Why we have it? And it seems to me that it's supposed to represent the voice of actually higher education itself in relation to the part of higher education and training and in relation to the various components of higher education. And thinking about that, I'm just wondering if it is fulfilling that role whether it is becoming what they call in the UK a quango, quasi non-governmental organization that just has lots of meetings and issues lots of nice ideas at great cost to taxpayers, but one's not entirely sure what the point of it all is. Now that argument is refuted by the fact that there's a hard edge to the CAG, which is that it has to do audits and evaluations and accreditations. Now that's a hard hit, because there you're actually saying, this thing is good, that thing is bad, and I'm making a ruling on it. But what seems to happen to the CAG over time is that it's actually detracted a bit on what I think of as the hard edge of its existence, and moved a little bit more towards the quango end, if I might put it that way. And that's the most visible in the fact that instead of continuing for audits of universities, which is what the original mandate seemed to have said it should do, it's now, quote, advising the minister on how to improve throughput, which is really a Department of Higher Education issue. It's a minister's issue. That is not really an issue that the CAG was originally designed to audit. So can I first express my concern that hard edge of what CAG does seems to have diminished in force. And I have no idea if there's a link between these two things. But the hard edge began, to my mind, to diminish at the same time as there was a very ignominious incident in the CAG where one of the audits of universities was actually not released because the vice chancellor objected to it not being released because he didn't like what it said about this university. And in that moment of not releasing that audit, that the CAGE abandoned its moral authority to make hard edge judgments about that. And sure enough, 5 years later, what you find is not even making those hard edge judgments so much anymore. So That is just an overall point. So what I want to ask then, given the kind of quango that I think the institution exists under, is what effect has all of your life actually had? You get lots of literature there, and don't forget that also has. He served in advice on the same things. The University of Cape Town Higher Education Department giving advice on the same things. The Academy of Science of South Africa giving advice on similar things. The Department of Higher Education having its own people who could give it advice. What does CHE actually add when it comes to this advice giving mode? Or is it simply, another pushy job for people who want to give advice? I'll tell you, I love all the CHE people, but really, this does worry me. Then my second point is I'm getting a bit more down to technical points now. What does it mean when it says you have an accumulated surplus? And I want to point out a hilarious thing to you. According to your figures, all of your income is in billions, did you know that? On page 77, I think it is. It looks as though everything you get is not 50 million, it's 50 billion. And I began to think, how much is this quango actually getting to do with us? Because at the top of each column, it says in thousands. And then below it, it gives in millions. So it's in thousands of millions. Actually, no, it's not 76. It's earlier. It's not in the AG section. It's in the earlier section. So anyway, according to that column, we've got a 45 billion accumulated surplus, actually put in 45 billion. Now, is that the same as when I rolled over? Because I'm unclear as to whether an accumulated surplus, is that when you haven't been doing your law? What is that all about? You can just explain that to some of you who don't get all the current issues of financial statements. Let's look at one of the hard-edged things you are doing, which is the evaluations of the professional degrees, law, social work, etc. Why the slowness there? Every time we have a higher education body coming along to the vicinity, they say, oh, well, we can't do X because the universities are holding us up. We can't do Y because the universities aren't delivering their LSAT money properly. We can't do Z because the academics take too long to make up their mind. Honestly, institutions, you just have to take responsibility for things not happening. You can't keep saying they're not doing it. That's the point I was making in this case as well. The institutions that are tasked with these things have to take responsibility for their non-delivery, even though we do understand that you depend on other people. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Pozzoli. Now, Ms. Kieran, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I must say I have not seen where the billions are, I'm keen to be pointed to that. Chairperson, just two brief questions, and then I would like to address the issue that Professor Pozzoli has raised. Just clarity, on page 100, overpayment to supplier, what does that relate to? If we could just be explained. And then secondly, what I understand about the concerns raised, and I think those are valid concerns, that the measuring tool is changing, and therefore, as a consequence of that, certain negative comments are made by the Auditor General. So it's the same institution, but they're using different tools, and that accounts for the Auditor General's comments. Is that what you have effectively said? That it's still the Auditor General's office doing the audit, but now they're using a different mechanism to assess you. So, but then I would like to cut to the last one. I must say, first of all, I think it's time to commend them for what they're doing. And it was interesting to hear the comment made by academics. I mean, what we understand is that many of them are doing a job for the love of it. Sometimes they probably use as consultants as well, but very often when their own academic institutions are demanding additional research, etc., is probably difficult for them. So I think what the limited funds allocated to the CHU, I think you are doing an excellent job. Secondly, I just reminded myself again of what your mandate is in terms of the Higher Education Act. Apart from your page 13, I just read through the Act itself again. What I understand is that you can, out of your own, assess and monitor the state of higher education. And in addition to that, you can respond to a request by the minister. Now, what I do believe, and that's why it's so important, is the intention in terms of the Act is to have an independent body that is overseeing the state of higher education. And I would like to commend you that apart from your new focus in terms of quality assurance, I think it's a welcome move, and I think we should actually encourage the CHU to do that. Because we are, on occasion, a lot of comments are made about our institutions and quality. And I think we need to have a body that can understand the disparities that come from the past and where your focus should be to do additional assistance and, you know, to render additional programs, etc., to bring parity in the sector. So, Chair, in fact, if the institution is facing, as the executive officer indicated, a real threat of inadequate funding because of rising salary sales, etc., they are doing such an important job. It's a matter that we must, as a committee, really take heed of and make sure that we confirm with the minister the important role that this institution is to fulfill. So I just wanted to have clarity about that, a few matters that I've raised, and I just wanted to make a comment to say to them, well done, and I think the renewed focus is a welcome shift. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Let me first welcome the report. I think it enabled us to understand what CHD is doing now. Now, and let me commend the CHD for exceeding in terms of performance on various targets. It exceeded the target on number of training workshops for evaluators too, instead of having one workshop. The MDG has 8 workshops. Okay? What impact did these workshops have on the budget? Because the target was 1, but it ended up having 8. Then what impact does this have on the budget? Secondly, according to the report, there were 53 approved positions. CHE then decided to fill 2 posts. The question is, were these posts budgeted for? If yes, what is happening to the money budgeted for the positions? The third question, I've heard the presenter saying that the BTEC will now be replaced by an advanced diploma. Then what will be the career path? Another question, what is the difference in credits of BTEC and the advanced diploma, if you have those details for us? Thank you.
Thank you very much to Honorable Mtono and over to you, Honorable Member Gadimi.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Let me first start by congratulating the institute for the work well done. My question emanates from page 64.
Let me remind members, let's embark on a robust, I'm not kidding that now, please let me just say, robust
Okay. Now my question, NRC from page 54, where it is reported that two male employees were recruited in a year under the review, and both of them left before the end of the initial year. And then I just want to understand what was the problem, because seemingly these employees left within a year. There must be a problem then. And thirdly, I want to check the equity plan of the entity, because when I hear that male employees were recruited, I just to think, why is it two males? Why isn't it male and female? Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity. There is a reason for CHE to exist, and part of the reason is for them to accredit certain programs that are offered in the higher education sector. There are two universities that are currently being established. I just want to know how many programs that you have accredited for these two institutions, Pumalanga and Tsol Plaatje, so far. And there are also pilots that you spoke about with regard to the Bachelor of Social Work and the LLB and MBA. And obviously there are some delays and in completing these pilots due to the nature or the availability or lack thereof of academic aspects to participate in the program. Now my question would be, has the CHE considered utilizing retired professors in the evaluation of qualifications? Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Mr. Sheila. Now come to Honorable Member Ketane.
Chair, the addition to Ms. Gunu's question regarding the one that says on your target, you targeted one workshop, you had eight. I mean, if you have eight, there must be an explanation. If there were two or three, I could understand. But eight is way beyond your plans. And why? What necessity does that? The other thing is those eight workshops, it isn't just the impact on finances, but also what really do you think it has on your whole program, on the whole education system? In other words, these things should happen, but we're interested to know why they are happening and whether they have achieved anything. The second point is on that alignment of academic and financial year, you said the financial year that was half year in some instances, second of the last quarter, something like that, but the point is they are not aligned with the academic year. Now, if you are advising the minister, and you spoke about family overseas a lot, why do you think overseas academic year starts after June? And you think, we're using the same Christian calendar. The difference might be, we might be a few hours behind overseas countries, or when our winter, our summer is hot, their December is cold, but basically the calendar is the same. Would you advise the minister, because this is a big problem. It is a big problem even for NSFAS and the army. We can't just keep on complaining about it. We must ultimately find a solution. Would you advise that our academic year be changed? Well, I'm sure psychologically to begin, I'm used to going back to school in January, so shop windows and visiting back to school in January when we were growing. But if the real need is there that we have our education system, we might have to consider changing that. The last one is one, when you're going to change the certificate to diploma, I didn't hear whether you're referring to technical and vocational. Because, you know, the ratio that 40% of our people must go to university, 60% to technical and vocational, means that even you, as a structure for higher institution, have to think about how to emphasize technical and vocational so that it carries more weight, it is more respected by industry and even our whole population. And the whole thing of accreditation will come into focus because now that things are changing and we are emphasizing technical and vocational for the majority of our people. Also the way you do things in terms of evaluating them and so on has to change. I just want to know if you have considered that.
I will now allow through you, Prof, responses from the council.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will start with the first question, but leave some of the questions to board members and management, especially when they're of technical nature. And the first question that was introduced by Professor Mazzoli, my sense is that the CAC continues to fulfill its role in terms of the Act. And in fact, we advise the minister, yes, on a number of things. There are different other bodies that do that, but we cannot stand in the way of the advice that is sought by the minister by other bodies, but that which falls within the framework of how we operate, we do that. The issue about an institution that didn't quite accept the audit was an unfortunate one, because I said that audit at that institution. And the audit went well, including the report and everything. So it was matters outside what the panel and, you know, have recommended. So things came up that were not supposed to drive issues, and it created a problem. And this coincided also with the new management coming into the CAG. So I think it was just a refocus on, based on the all the audits that we did, including the ones that are not closed, we thought because of the size of the problem in the sector, let us begin first by focus on teaching and learning. You know, the reward system by and large is for research, and all the research intensive institutions, they do much more research and so on and so forth. But teaching is in the background, although it is funded, but we need to see how best we can improve this to produce better graduates. I mean, there are all sorts of concerns that come from employers about the standard of our graduates, LLB being one of them, that people are not able to actually perform at the level that is expected. So I will leave the other questions to other members so that they have the opportunity. I don't monopolize the forum, because that's how I operate.
Madam Chair, if I may, I would like to also respond to Professor Mazzoli's question about what is the role of the CHE, what does it serve? And I differ from her in her position that the institutional audits constitute the hard edge of the work of the CHE. I was part of two audits on The first one, I organized at my own institution. I was instrumental in preparing the institution for the institutional audit. And the second one, I was part of the audit panel of another institution. And it's actually the way that institutional audits are run is you audit the quality assurance arrangements of the institution. So if an institutional management does not take the institutional audit process seriously and decides to use that process for the internal improvement of the institution, it can very easily become a bureaucratic process. So I would contend that the hard edge of the CHP rather lies with program accreditation and with national reviews, because that is where the quality really meets the student in terms of the program that we offer. And I think that is the big role that the CHE plays. If we look at the work that's currently being done by the CHE in terms of research and accreditation and so on, it actually addresses the real touch of the problem that we have in South Africa in higher education, and that is the fact that 50% of our undergraduate students leave the system without a qualification, and only 27% of the students complete their first qualification in the regulation time. That makes our system ineffective and wasteful. And all the work that the CHE is currently doing in terms of the undergraduate curriculum proposals, the new focus on building capacity around teaching and learning in our institutions, the program accreditation, the teaching excellence awards, etc., are all focused to address that problem. So I think the work that the CHE is doing currently is spot on looking at the real big, big problem in our higher education system today. Thank you, Chair.
Response for you, madam. Yeah, yes, Professor. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that, you know, these questions are always really helpful in terms of what role does an institution play, and I think over a period of time it's always important to review it. So I think that that question is coming at an opportune time. Just to research, I mean, I think that any kind of buffer body in the way that the CHE is situated stands between two competing kind of groupings, and the one is the government and the other is higher education institutions. And as buffer body, the CHE has to try and balance out the needs of both. And I think in that sense, at times, the focus would be, depending on the client, would be on certain things and others it would shift it. So at the first point, I think that the significance of the CHE is that whilst it's important to mention groupings such as AFAS and other interest groups, they are, by their very nature, quite narrow and they have to defend their own interests. And the CHE, for me and for our society, moves beyond what could be defined as our own institutional-led interest groups, and it gives a kind of landscape view of the challenges that faces our society as we undergo transformation. And the key challenge at the moment is that we're just not getting our students through. And there's a racial profile to that. We do not have the next generation of academics. Now, the CHE comes in terms of advising how to move our society forward at the systems level with evidence-based research. It's not just on the view or the opinion of an individual. So I think that, you know, to restate that the CHE has abandoned its model of voice, I would argue that given the kind of the challenges of transformation at the moment, that CHE is actually continuously trying to reclaim and assert the moral authority of higher education, what it means for our society in its totality. And the key challenge that we as the CHE faces, and it needs to be stated, is that It doesn't matter what you do in terms of intervention. Institutions tell you, do not come in, because we have the preserve of institutional autonomy. So I think that is where the greatest challenge is, if we want to effect change in our country over the next 2 decades. Thank you.
So, Prof, my apology, but thank you for your intervention, but also Professor Fava, thank you for your intervention. I don't know if I'll be wrong to ask the department to just share with us about the regulations that are in place to at least regulate and ensure that universities, you know, autonomy is a bit, I would not say neutralized, so it would be a wrong way, but at least it makes investors to be flexible. I don't know if I'm right. Please, can you share with us, because I think it's important that maybe for your good self, all the investors are workshopped on these regulations so that they become aware and then cooperate with government.
Thank you, Chair. I think you're referring to the new reporting regulations that have just been published and will be put into the system next year. I think all universities are going to have to do the first strategic plan and ASP and provide that to the university, to the department. It is part of the accountability mechanisms that are have been developed in conjunction with the sector itself and with AG to ensure that we have clear accountability from all of the institutions. This is not really about encroaching on university's autonomy, but it is about public accountability. The department is also in the process of developing key financial indicators that will be utilized to analyze the various reports that come in from the sector. So I think, I'm not sure if that's enough for you, but in terms of the work that we do on other sides of the system, I think important issue is that, in terms of that, the higher education system, the three particular steering mechanisms. It's funding and planning, which the department has a responsibility for, and then there's quality assurance and development, which the CHE and its HQC have responsibility for. And from that point of view, I think there's also an interlink. I mean, the CHE is an autonomous institution that advises the minister, but certainly these mechanisms need to work together to improve quality in the system and to improve system. And I think maybe also just in relation to the QEP project, the quality enhancement project, I'd like to say that it's the very first time that we as a department have got the teacher development grant that work to provide funding, and the CHE has the quality enhancement program, and these two things are going to work together to look at how we can improve teaching and learning in the system. And I think it's actually a very, very important advance in towards improving quality and system.
I do need to comment quickly on the issue that Professor Bazzoli raised. I think it's not quite correct to say the main part of all work is to advise the minister. The main part of the CFE's work is quality assurance, and quite frankly, the minister has no authority over quality assurance. And neither does the council. The HEQC, which is made up of academic experts, makes the decisions on accreditation and audits. Without reference, it doesn't get identified by the council, it doesn't go to the ministry. So in a sense, from a certain perspective, the HEQC operating role is, to use an analogy with the university, almost like a shepherd for academic affairs. Okay, so I think it's, we need to understand that in a sense that the advisory role is a mandatory role in terms of the certain things the minister has to come to the CHC for. He or she doesn't have to accept the advice or can accept part of the advice and so forth. I think it's also, and let me say, because I was responsible for this, I don't think the audit process and the move to the quality enhancement project had anything to do with the UKZN fiasco. Okay? And it was a fiasco for a very reason. It had to do with the fact to say within a set of audits over 10 years, and as Professor said, then depends on how institutions, in fact, it's not hard, because we don't have the authority to say to the institution, you must implement these findings of the audit. It's only the minister has that. And that raises the issue of autonomy and so forth. It's a really shame, having done 10 years of audits, do we want to reintroduce a new cycle of audits? Well, we're over-auditing institutions in the way that we do. And then what is the key challenge that we face? And this is not about advising the minister about to enhance quality. It's about how we get the sector to work together to say how do we improve teaching and learning so that we address what is a key problem is the lack of the failure of poor throughput and so forth. So I think there's a different context to understanding why we made this shift. And we're also not suggesting that there will not be any audits to be undertaken. There may be well be audits on a smaller scale, for instance, to give an example, in relation to the governance project, we may want to audit what institutional councils do. That will be a sort of more focused, narrower audit than the big change which takes 18 months to do and so forth. In relation, I don't think there's any reference to billions. I think there's a reference to thousands, which are millions, in the document. I'll check that. But the accumulated surplus really refers to the fact that in the last 4 or 5 years, starting with the situation where we had fairly large numbers of vacancies, which also then impacted on the projects we were meant to do or not to. So we've got an accumulated surplus of 10 million rand, which is largely to do with, which is what is all over that we will get, that we are treasury to approve this year. So it's not a very large amount, and it's giving us a bit of breathing space in terms of our current budget. In relation to the BTEC, the BTEC is being replaced by an advanced diploma. It's a one-year qualification, 120 credits. The reason the VTEC was taken out, and Dr. Kubera was part of the department when it very first started, is because the VTEC was being seen by the then technicons and the current universities of technology as the equivalent of an honors degree. That after 3 years diploma, you did an added year, and it was the equivalent of an honors. And in our view, that was the statement, that you can't equate 3 years diploma with 3 years degree and then say an additional year gives you an honors. So it's creating a different type of qualification which is more in tune with what should follow a 3 year diploma. So it won't preclude somebody from doing postgraduate work, but instead of 1 year, it will take them 2 years in order to enter a master's or a master's program. In relation to the issue of the two new universities, we accredited two programs for the University of Mpumalanga and two for the University for Saul Plaatje. And Saul Plaatje also had one or two programs that they inherited from the teacher training course. I forget the exact figure, but it's not more than four, maybe five programs that we accredited. The issue of the delays is not so much the nature of the process. I was referring to that particular standards development, not to the general work that we do. But because we want to bring the academic community to decide what is the standard for the qualification of the program. And that's a slow process, because it's to get, the academics don't think about the standard, they don't think about necessarily what is it that we want our graduates to do. It was quite interesting doing the MBA. It's taken them a long time to come to agreement about what an MBA is and what is it that they expect
an MBA graduate to that and so forth. That's the delay I was talking about, rather than that this procrastination. It's really intellectual engagement about developing and getting agreements so that the academic community accepts that this is the standard we're going to work towards that we aspire to. So the nature of the process is that, in that sense, we respect academic autonomy and freedom. We don't want to, or we don't have the ability to impose a standard because we don't have the expertise to impose that standard. In relation to the issues, sorry, overseas trips, what we were really saying is we don't travel a lot overseas, that's why we don't spend a lot of money on overseas trips. It hasn't got to do with the nature of the academic year and so forth. In terms of the bears that have, I don't think we can't remember. I think one of them was recruited by Visa at a very high salary, which we couldn't afford, I think. But largely, as I said before, people leave us in middle-level positions because there's very limited career opportunities and career progression in this AT for people to do so. We do have an equity plan, we just have difficulty. I'm not sure, maybe it's the quality assurance tends to be more, in fact, all the quality assurance managers in institutions also tend to be female. I'm not sure what the correlation is, but it's not that, for some reason, the nature of the work, maybe it's somebody who needs, I better not get into trouble about what I'm saying. In relation to workshops, well, we projected, just because we had a lot more accreditation, because we were doing the HPC alignment process, so HPSF alignment process, we decided that the nature of the process requires us to do a lot more training of people that we were using than we anticipated. Didn't impact on our budget because we were working within the budget that we have. I can assure you, because I know it was an issue before, that we will not spend more than we have. We don't do the capacity. We budget according to what we have. The process that we're not closed, the money stays, is probably out of the accumulated surplus. So we didn't close the post, not because we needed the money, but for the work that we were doing, those directors, we didn't immediately need their administrative support for which the post had been paid. So we may either review whether we continue with those posts or restructure them, but it's part of our current organogram and it's budgeted for. The final point, okay, I'll now hand over to the CFO to talk about the overbet. Oh, the AG, sorry, the only issue we had with the AG, I know the CFO tends to get a bit more irritated about the AG, but he's new to the CAG, is that what happens with the AG is, the AG comes in every year. Sometimes we reach agreement with the AG about how we're going to do something. The next year there's a new manager from the AG. And the new manager says, well, I'm a new manager, I'm a new kid on the block. What you agreed with last year is not what I'm going to do. So it makes it very difficult in that sense in terms of consistency because this often relies on different ways of interpreting. So it's not about incorrect, but it's different interpretations that different managers do. And that's our concern, is how from year on year, when the AG comes, when we think we've agreed on something the previous year, and the one big area we have problems with the AG is accreditation. Because the nature of the process is complicated. The AG works on the financial level. You say you've got so many programs that were submitted, why were the decisions not made? And we say we go through a process that straddles in 2 years. So you may see in our annual report on the indicators, we've now resorted to what's it, percentage. We're going to 100% of the programs that we received. Last year, AG said, well, you said 100%, but you've only done 90%. But we said that's because when a program comes to us, goes to the evaluator, if there's a problem, we send it back to the institution, goes back to the evaluator, HQC may not agree, and so forth. So it's normally it takes 3 to 6 months, but it can take longer depending on the nature of the program. The AG likes to work in black and white. We have difficulties sometimes in all ways. So if you take, and I think it's an issue that's worth raising. The AG wants to know how many pieces of advice. We say 100%. The AG says we want a number. Well, we say we can't predict the number of pieces of advice the minister is going to ask us in any given year. And quite frankly, when the AG comes, and I say this with respect to the AG, we could give them 5 pieces of paper with different headings. All they're interested in is to comply with what the minister did. The quality of our advice is absolutely nonsense. And that doesn't matter in terms of performance indicator table that we have. I think it's something we need to think about more generally.
Thank you, sir. Yes, just remember, I think the issue of the overpayment is applicable and overpayment to supply, which happens much when my team was running and trying to pay, and because of the system failure right then, then this one document is short. I can safely tell you that we have the record that the supply was informed and the money was recovered immediately. And in the audit report from it is not reflected because we have, when we finalized the audit, we wanted to see that the money was recovered from the service provider. And it's not even part of the finding. Yes. Thank you.
Well, I've been listening with interest where CEO has been talking about the AGU. You know that the AGU is an independent institution. And unfortunately, the AGU must give the AGU what she wants. otherwise, you get an audit query. Okay, so that's fine. Thank you very much. I think there's only one area where I need a response from you there. It's when the CFO reported that a fraud that was committed in 2007 was only detected in 2013. Now the question is, why did it take so long to detect it? Didn't you have a fraud prevention strategy? And I'm going to hasten to ask if you have a strong management and risk management unit. And after this, I would also like to request Mr. Iodo, please forgive me for now. These names are so many, and I'm okay. I may try to forget the names, but in the passage of time, I can assure you. That time, I will not make this secrecy. All right, Mr. Trejo, I also want you to comment on the financial statement and after you responded about the management unit.
When fraud happened in 2007, neither CFO, nor any of the council members were in place. It clearly there were clearly problems with the internal control systems. It was a manual system that was checked, it was drawn on charge for pay as well. We detected it in 2012, but that's when charge realized that it hadn't been paid. And they contacted us, and then we did an investigation, which suggested that the check had been drawn, but had not deposited into the SARS account. We immediately reported the matter. It's been currently investigated by the police services. We understand they're making progress in identifying where the fraud. We fairly convinced that the fraud happened internally, because we looked through our records and for the particular month or particular transaction at the time the fraud occurred, the paperwork is missing. But I can't tell you why in 2007 it occurred and what the problem was. I can say fairly confidently that the internal control systems that we have now would detect the kind of problem that particular debt fraud involved. You may have collected, or this committee may not, or this committee was not in place, but in, as I indicated at the outset, CAFIF did in 20, for a whole range of reasons, it had administrative systems in the past were very strong. And all of that has been addressed in the last 3 or 4 years. So we don't have an internal risk unit. We are too small an organization to afford an internal risk unit. We also have our internal audit, and they perform a role. And then we have an audit risk committee that oversee what is going on. But we don't have formally an internal risk.
Actually, very little to report. Just as far as CIG in general, these things are good standing. And they are very much reliant on the government grant that they receive, because they do not have a lot of feasibility to generate a revenue. And we trust that will continue. In terms of the problem with the IG that was raised, I think that's a general problem that public entities and even some departments experience. And even as we explained yesterday, there are areas where there is differences in opinion. There are various kinds of interpretations of some of the disclosure requirements. and that result in aspects to be investigated. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, and next year when you've got a new audit, you find it in from scratch. So that is happening. Just to clarify, the issue of the billions is not in the financial statements, everything there is in order, but it is in the HR disclosure information where there's a few commas not where they are supposed to be. But everything else, otherwise, in order. Thank you, Jim.
And if I could, what I know is that if there is no movement on the deficit, the entity might see itself taking a nosedive instead of an unqualified just of getting a qualified. So what's the number to turn it down? The deficit, because I know the whole reported on a deficit, all right? Or is yourself new? Yes. So what are you doing about it? Because if you don't turn it around, I can show you.
What we said is we currently have a rollover service which covers us, and we get income from accreditation. We don't budget for the deficit. The point I was making is simply that if the current situation continues and the salaries go up but our operational budget does not increase, we will come to a point where we would have to look carefully at what our priorities are, and we may have to cut either staff or certain of the projects. So we're not budgeting for this. At the moment, we're managing with the funds that we have, but the deficit was the core funding that we received. But because we have a service and because we also generate income from the accreditation of private institutions, and it just so happens that it's been going up in the last few years, so we managed to balance our books. But we would have to cut projects or stop whatever, if that's the situation. But we, as I wrote you earlier in the year, we do not need that support.
Thank you very much. Close. I'll request the chairperson, professor, to give us your closing statement.
Thank you, chairperson. I think in closing, the work that we do at the CT, I have tried to address the triple challenge that we have in the country. Mainly the employability of graduates is the quality of the qualifications that are in the system come out, it increases the level of employability of graduates. And so the reputation of an institution and how it does its work in fact benefits the students as well. And one aspect that leads to funding that in my view is a bit of a problem, but outside our control. You know, the entire economic climate all over the world does not enable us to succeed to get some of the grants that we used to get from big organizations like the Mellon Foundation and so on to expand the kind of work that we do. Thank you, John.
Committee, I would once again thank you for availing yourself for this important meeting, and also to reiterate that education remains an apex priority, as pronounced by our president, and I see you having a role also to play so that this country can be taken to greater heights. And quality in our education system and higher education in particular should not be compromised. And for that, we are counting on you. Because I can see this entity is full of professors, so I can comfortably say, we really would like to count on you. Well, I must say that the work that you do to quality assure and accredit university qualification is invaluable to our country, and we commend you for the work well done so far. I just don't want the CFO to be and the CEO to be complacent on the unqualified. But it's a
I think there must be a movement and it must be an upward movement. I'm saying this because indeed it is true that the Auditor General wasn't happy that after submission of the action plan, there has not been any improvement. Improvement in terms of, when I'm talking about improvement in terms of moving from unsupervised to a clean audit. Well, the action plan is aimed at bringing things around and pushing them to another level. So I know that that is something that at the end of this current financial year, we'll be looking forward to a clean audit. You have the capacity. If you obtain this over the years, I'm sure that we don't want you to get rid of the comfort zone, we want you to move. Thank you very much for the work well done. Well, Professor Jay, all that I can say to you is that the sign is the limit. Thank you. See you in the near future. I know you invited us. You invited us to come over, we'll look at our plans, depending on the, you don't have 50 things like that. Depending on the availability of resources, we will come. We honor the invitation. Thank you very much. Meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.